This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, August 22nd, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. For citizens of Hong Kong feeling the stresses of pressure from Beijing, one option offered by a British parliamentarian is this: give Hong Kongers British citizenship. What are the implications of that plan? Could it actually lower tensions? Generally, what does pressure from expats do to or for their home countries? Cato's Chris Preble and Alex Narasta comment. A British parliamentarian, the chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, whose name I will not try to pronounce, but it's his first name is Tom, he suggests that as a means of reassurance, and I assume this means to protesters in Hong Kong, Great Britain should provide citizenship to people in Hong Kong. And others have suggested that, frankly, this should have happened 20 years ago when Hong Kong negotiated the transfer of that hunk of land to China. So, Chris, you have some thoughts about this idea. You know, as a foreign policy matter, that would be both a nice gesture, but could it be perceived as threatening in a way?
Well, I don't really think it would be perceived as threatening, and it's certainly not as threatening as other things that the U.S. government or other governments might threaten to do against the Chinese government if they were to use force against protesters in Hong Kong. This all started, we had a conversation among scholars, just an informal lunch discussion, and Ryan Bourne called my attention to this, which I had not seen. And I recalled an article that I wrote many years ago, long ago, in Reason Magazine, sort of talking about how libertarians should approach helping people who are suffering under authoritarian governments. And one of the ways that I had said at the time was, if authoritarian governments are confronted with the prospect of their people leaving, might they reconsider their policies in a way to try to prevent the brain drain? Simon Lester, who was also in this meeting, he pointed out, well, maybe they would be happy to get rid of the troublemakers, and on balance, they decide that it's not worth making the reforms. Of course, we have a very dramatic example of this in East Germany in the Cold War, where the East German government, confronted with a mass exodus of talented people, ultimately in 1962 chose to throw up a wall to prevent them from leaving. It turns out, I didn't know this. It was very fortuitous. Emma Ashford pointed out to me a body of literature by political scientist Albert Hirschman, who wrote about what's called exit voice and loyalty. So there's a whole body of literature about this. And over the course of the last couple of days, I've been reading this and learning more about this whole notion. Is it, do you provide an incentive for people to speak up against a government if they believe they can leave, or do they just leave and not try to change the government from within? So it turns out that there's some tension between these two options of either exiting or speaking up, exit or voice.
Alex, has this ever happened before? That is to say, people in some sort of dire straits being offered essentially citizenship somewhere else?
Not citizenship per se, but a lot of countries have offered folks in neighboring or close countries the ability to leave and get basically essentially immediate permanent residence in this country. So the United States did this with Cubans. And we've welcomed until 2016, when President Obama ended the wet foot, dry foot policy, the United States has welcomed several waves of Cubans and essentially let them stay by granting them very simple, easy rules to permanent residency, much easier than have been offered to basically any other group of people. In Canada, in 1989, they changed the rules to allow folks from Hong Kong who are studying in China, in Canada, to basically be able to stay if they want to. And that was done in direct for two reasons. One, Canada realized these folks were very talented, skilled, and gaining an excellent education in Canada. And two, a lot of them were worried about going back to Hong Kong because of the impending transition of its governance to China in 1997. As a result, from about 1989 to 1997, 225,000 people from Hong Kong immigrated to Canada, which is a substantial proportion of that city-state's population. Now, after the immediate transition of sovereignty to China, things didn't really get worse in Hong Kong. The Chinese government was pretty good for a little while, not making things too totalitarian anyway. So a lot of those folks got dual citizenship in Canada. They went back to Hong Kong to continue work because it's such a vibrant and free economy. And now a lot of them are going back to Canada, partly because they're older now and retiring, but also partly because of the increased repression in Hong Kong put upon by the Chinese central communist government. In fact, many of the warnings issued by the Chinese government to foreign governments not to meddle in what's going on have been directed to Canada, because Canadians of Chinese descent who are there are very involved and vocal in a lot of these protests.
Right. And that's one of the things I saw in one of the articles that Emma shared, is the ability for exile communities to organize and mobilize and pressure their former homes to reform from outside as expatriates, as exiles, is much greater in the modern era than it was, you know, several generations ago. And so I do think you see in the case, you know, Alex points to a great example of the, you know, the Chinese being concerned. I mean, yeah, the Chinese government being concerned about Chinese expats in Canada. In earlier periods, you know, Saddam Hussein was worried about Iraqi expatriates here in the United States. The Iranian government is concerned about Iranian expatriates. Those folks mostly fled after the revolution, right, in 79. So there are certainly examples where large expatriate communities continue to be a pressure group from the outside. And then the question is, are they more effective speaking out as expatriates, or would they have been more effective had they remained in the country and continued to pressure from the inside?
And there is, as Chris mentioned, you know, a wide literature on this. We wrote a short paper about this in 2015. So just a summary of this literature, not looking at revolutionary changes or massive changes in government, sort of marginal changes when it comes to political freedom and economic freedom, just summarizing some of the literature on this. So it's not just radical changes that occur, but folks who leave, say, African countries that are poor, or the Philippines, or other countries, or even Mexico that come to the United States or other liberal Western countries, when they return home, or sometimes with just communication with folks back in their home countries, it creates liberal change there, sort of along these margins. So there's a wonderful example of the PRI party, which dominated Mexican politics from the 1920s up through the 1990s. And the way they won re-elections was by going to local areas and say, the amount of money you get for social programs depends on the vote share for the PRI. That began to break down when Mexicans who came to the U.S. in large numbers in the 1980s and 1990s were sending money back home. So their families had another source of revenue. They weren't dependent anymore upon PRI largesse in order to sustain themselves, in order to do well economically. That sort of broke the back of this party monopoly in Mexico. There have been a lot of institutional changes in Mexico since then that are largely positive. Adoption of better trade agreements, privatization of state-owned enterprises, et cetera, as a result of this. So by having folks leave, it's certainly influences, I think, more revolutionary situations, but it can also influence just marginal, smaller changes too.
So, Chris, as a foreign policy matter, if Great Britain were to make this sort of blanket guarantee to people in Hong Kong, do you think that would quell protests to the happiness of the Chinese, or might it make things more tense there?
Well, I have a hard time seeing how things get much more tense, again, short of violence, which is something that, you know, I check my Twitter feed every day or several times a day to see if we've tipped over into that, because there's been, you know, concern about that for you know, a couple of weeks now. But short of violence, I think that it could be a safety valve of sorts. That's sort of how other people have looked at these sorts of protest movements in the past. Look, let's be clear. Relocating away from family and friends to a foreign country is a difficult decision. Most people don't do it. And so while there is usually some path of exit available, most people would prefer to stay in the place of their birth or where their families are, and to try to make them better from the inside. But Hirschman's argument is that the ability to leave is both sort of a fundamental human right. This is sort of our perspective as libertarians, but it also can have reform effects. And so, you know, when you write something, what was it? It was 14 years ago. No. 16 years ago, when you write something 16 years ago and you go back and look at it and you sort of cringe a little bit and say, you know, I was young, I was naive, and I didn't know what I was talking about. But I look at this passage and I say, I kind of shrug my shoulders and say, well, maybe I was onto something. There seems to be some truth to that. And really, it was a fun experience for me to learn what others, others in other disciplines here at Cato knew about this already, what Alex and his team had written about over the, you know, that I wasn't familiar with. And so as a foreign policy matter, it's a reminder that foreign policy isn't just about foreign policy. It's about, it touches on lots of other policy matters as well.
So, you know, Great Britain feels a responsibility to people of Hong Kong in some ways, and the people of Hong Kong are entitled to have that responsibility bestowed upon them. But are there any groups of people that the United States has some responsibility for? I'm thinking with respect to Mexico, a great deal of the cost of the U.S.-led war on drugs has fallen on Mexico, and the United States has exerted enormous pressure on countries throughout the world to undertake their own wars on drugs. Does the United States have any responsibility to the countries where we have essentially imposed a lot of U.S. policy?
I wouldn't say legal. I'd say maybe from a moral perspective, but then we might argue that governments don't really have moral obligations. Governments have legal responsibilities and obligations. Look, there have been many instances, not just in the context of the drug war. I think it's a good question, Caleb, but in the wake of the collapse of the South Vietnamese government in Southeast Asia, you had not merely Vietnamese fleeing from South Vietnam. You also had the Hmong population who the United States had worked with in Cambodia, many of whom came to the United States. There have been other instances. There have been concerns, for example, about Iraqi refugees, people who had worked with the U.S. government as translators and facilitators during the U.S. Military presence there during the late aughts. Kurdish population. Now, of course, we're talking about perhaps a durable peace settlement of some sort with the Afghan people. Will some Afghans will they not be confident in their ability to live safely in Afghanistan after the U.S. departure? How will we treat their applications for refugee status or to emigrate to the United States? I think each of these are sort of taken on a case-by-case basis.
And another example is the Philippines. So the United States government during World War II offered green cards to Filipinos who fought in insurgencies and along American troops to liberate the Philippines. After the war, those promises were not followed well. But later on, decades after the war, they were sort of followed pretty much across the line. The Trump administration recently ended that program after they assumed that basically everyone who was going to take advantage of that program had already done so. But that was just, you know, one of the many examples that, in addition to what Chris mentioned, of the U.S. government feeling some kind of responsibility. But most of those have to do with, U.S. military involvement overseas, not so much like a U.S. colonial responsibility, which some folks think the U.S. has had toward Cuba or should have had toward Cuba or the Philippines at different times, and that might have influenced our policies toward Cuba at different times. But I think the main reason was we had communist country right off our border, and no matter whether that was an American colony at one time or not, I think we probably would have had the same policy toward them.
Right. I mean, Philippines is unique because they were one of the only, you know, former U.S. colonies to actually attain independence, whereas Great Britain, the U.K., has many such countries that had that status. So I do think it's hard to find similar cases, many similar cases in the U.S. experience, whereas with respect to the Brits, there are many such instances.
Chris Preble is Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Alex Narasta directs Immigration Policy Studies. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.